Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Helen Crane. And coming up, it may be 2 months away, but the questions are already being asked. So what will be in the autumn budget? Just how painful will it be? Also today, first-time buyers could now be able to secure bigger mortgages when applying with Halifax. Crane takes on everyone's least favourite delivery firm. Well, mine, at least. Plus, what if bad brotherly blood blows up the Oasis reunion? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
First, the Prime Minister has warned us that the autumn budget on 30th of October will be painful as Sir Keir looks to balance Britain's books. But that job has been made harder because he's already promised not to increase income tax, national insurance and VAT. Instead, those with the, quote, broadest shoulders should bear the heaviest burden, suggesting there will be tax rises elsewhere. We already know about the cut to winter fuel payments and VAT on private schools, but what else could the Chancellor unveil at the end of October? Simon, Helen, welcome. Simon, what do we know so far? What has the PM said and why?
Well, in their election campaign and in their manifesto, the Labour Party made some promises about tax rises, largely to head off the accusations of the Tories that Labour would raise taxes on you. That's one of the reasons why swing voters don't vote Labour. In elections, they don't vote Labour because they're worried they're going to whack up the taxes and they're going to do something crazy and potentially prove to be, you know, economically or, you know, organisationally incompetent. The Tories faced a difficult job this time round, having whacked up people's taxes themselves and displayed not an entirely spotless record on competence over recent years, including maintaining the same Prime Minister for longer than an item you might find in your fridge. So, Labour, smarts, were like, right, we're not going to put taxes up. And they made a promise not to put up some of the cornerstone taxes that bring in most of the tax revenue. They actually promised to not put up the rates of those taxes. So, you know, they could theoretically just reduce the higher rate tax threshold down to £20,000 if they wanted to, and they would still be meeting their commitment. There was a lot of questions asked of them of like, well, how exactly are you going to do this? Because the country's finances aren't that great. We've got this massive debt pile. We're now paying quite a lot of money in interest because interest rates have gone up so much. So what are you going to do? You need to find some money from somewhere. There were quite a lot of very well-respected economists, economic forecasters, Institute for Fiscal Studies, for example, pointing out that whether, you know, you were looking at what the Labour Party was saying or the Tory Party was saying, stuff just didn't add up and taxes were going to rise. Keir Starmer was very keen to point out that he was not going to raise taxes on working people. I think it was on working people, wasn't it? I can't remember the exact phrase, but it definitely still left some room for manoeuvre. So there was this like, well, what could they do kind of thing. But the election happened. They were elected. And if you cast your mind back a few podcasts a couple of months ago and listen to the tone there, there was a note of optimism. It's like, whether you voted Labour or not, you know, it was a time for change. That was what they stood for. And, you know, we were going to move on. We were going to make Britain great again. We were going to, you know, step things up. There was a degree of optimism in the air of like, right, come on. Okay. Whether you wanted this or not, it's time for a bit of a reset. Let's get going. In one of the stranger moves I've seen in recent times, Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer have been extremely keen to pour vast quantities of ice cold, freezing, gloomy water on any post-election optimism that existed.
It's true.
It's like having the birthday party that you have spent years organizing for one of your big birthdays And then everybody turns up and they all really want to celebrate and have a good time. And you just wander around going, it's rubbish. To be honest, it's rubbish. We're not going to have a good time. We're going to finish early. In fact, I'm taking all the booze away. I'm old. Yeah, exactly. It's bizarre. And I don't think you can't talk yourself into a recession. And I don't think you can talk yourself out of an economic recovery either. But you can certainly move stuff around the margins. And the sentiment, the change in sentiment in, let's be clear, is like we're talking 2 and a bit months is really quite spectacular. And it's not the public that have been responsible for that change of sentiment. It's the people in charge who presumably would benefit from some positive sentiment at the moment. So I'm absolutely baffled as to what they're doing. But what they are doing is rolling the pitch for some potential tax rises to come in an October budget. October the 30th. Not a great day to call a budget on. I mean, it's Halloween the next day and all that kind of stuff. October 30th, we're going to get a budget and there's the right what taxes are going to rise. Mm. Because Rachel Reeves discovered her £22 billion black hole, which she blamed the Tories for covering stuff up, spending money that they didn't say they were spending and so on, not declaring. Tories said, no, we didn't do that. Let's leave that to one side. And then Keir Starmer came out and gave us a very, very gloomy speech. Yeah. This week, he out-gloomed his chancellor. Yeah. It's all about what are they going to do? How are they going to hit us? And the broadest shoulders is basically code for not middle earners. You can't say middle earners because middle earners are by definition on the median salary, which is about £35,000. But it's what often gets referred to as middle earners, which is more the kind of like lower end of the higher rate tax paying up to the kind of then into the, you know, £100,000 plus. Those are the people who are going to get walloped, we suspect. Not the very, very rich people who are actually genuinely the people with the broadest shoulders, because there's not as many of them. And so it's much harder to get loads of tax off them and they can move their money around in a much easier way. So it's basically, you know, the same muggins who've seen the tax burden increase massively on them under the Tories, who, it should be noted, have actually followed a policy over many years of taxing the rich more and the poor and middle earners less. But that's just not the narrative that normally gets put forward.
So this is the thing, I'm confused, Helen, because they did say they don't want to tax workers, but middle earners are earning money, probably working. The unemployed famously don't have a lot of spare cash to be taxed. So does that leave pensioners, kids, again, not a famous group that you can tax, I mean, they can try, and businesses?
I think when they talk about not wanting to tax workers, perhaps what they really mean is they don't want to tax income that has come from working. So it looks like what they're going to focus on is things like essentially wealth taxes, so capital gains tax, you know, returns on investments or second homes and things like that, or inheritance tax. For example, if you say inherit a home or some assets from someone, so it's money that you might be a working person, you might well be a working person, you probably are, but it's money that hasn't come from working. So they don't want to put up tax on salaries, but they're going to, it sounds like, put up tax on things that people haven't worked to gain. And that's quite a controversial idea. You know, the most kind of emotive thing that comes into it is people passing on their homes to, you know, their children or other family members. You know, okay, that's it's a nice sort of bonus to have in your life, and not everyone has that. But should those people be kind of penalised for sort of handing on a family home and things like that? That's where it becomes, I think, more of a kind of controversial idea. Because, you know, people who are in that, as Simon said, that bracket that sometimes gets called middle earners, you know, people £50,000, £60,000, £70,000 a year, you know, they've worked hard and they've, you know, done, as people say, the right things. They bought a property, they've sort of been sensible with their money, they've made investments. And should they get penalised for kind of passing those on? That's that's the real issue around this, I think.
So we'll talk a little bit more about pension tax relief in more detail. But you mentioned there, Helen, capital gains, I mean, inheritance tax, but dividend tax. I mean, we've already seen the thresholds cut drastically. So what it will mean is you will pay more tax? Is that what the prediction is? I mean, what are the likely scenarios with something like capital gains tax or inheritance tax or dividend tax? What are we likely to see? Simon, Helen?
It should be noted that most people don't pay capital gains tax.
Only about 3% in the last 10 years.
Yes, but the statistics are not reliable. And the reason why the statistics are not reliable is because they are based on a point when the capital gains tax free threshold was £12,300. In his wisdom, the previous Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, has reduced that first to £6,000 and then to £3,000. So the hurdle for paying capital gains tax is now much, much lower. Having said that, most people still wouldn't pay it because you can avoid it. You just don't sell your investments, or you don't sell the property. You don't do the act that triggers the tax bill. But what it does mean is that by reducing that threshold by that much, it's going to drag many, many more people into its net. And it's going to disproportionately fall on small investors who've built up investments outside of ISAs. And if you've got, you know, long-term investments outside of an ISA, then it's quite possible that you will have made those kind of gains. We have a question on the site today from a reader, okay, which is that they're 45. They were given shares as a BAE shares as a child that are now worth £7,000. They have no idea who bought them for them or when. So they don't know what the original price was, but they're that they owe, you know, more than the £3,000 on this. They've had dividends reinvested and so on. How on earth do they work out the tax? So someone in that position is going to owe capital gains. Wind the clock back a year and a half to before the allowance was slashed, they would have been fine. They wouldn't have had to pay anything. A lot of people with share save schemes are going to have them outside of an ISA. Now, when you invest in a share save scheme with your work and you build up shareholdings, you could move those into an ISA, but most people don't do it. They just leave them sitting there. There will be lots of pensioners, for example, who have investments they've built up over the years. And people say, well, the ISA allowance is £20,000, but the ISA allowance has only been £20,000 in recent history. Before that, it was considerably lower. And if you go back, you know, quite a lot of time, people will have held smaller amounts, you know, will have held money outside of an ISA and so on. It also, you know, disproportionately affects people who have dividends. So for example, the dividend allowance has been cut, and you know, it used to be £2,000, it's now £500. And the way the capital gains tax rate works is that the idea is that you've got an allowance, and then above that you pay capital gains on your profits. If you hold shares, then you can just drip sell them in order to try to like stay below the limit, but with a £3,000 limit, that's much harder. But if you're making a big gain, then it's much harder to do that. So for example, if you're selling a property or you're selling a business, then, you know, you can't do that gradually in the same way. You can try to do it with your business, but you'd have to take a long time to sell a business to just do £3,000 a year, and you can't do it with a property. So buy-to-let investors, second home investors. And there is an argument that capital gains tax is lower because people are taking either an entrepreneurial or an investment risk. Income, you know, certainly income from employment is a guaranteed sum. You're not taking the risk in the same way. This is the same reason why self-employed people benefit from some lower taxes at certain points, is because they are taking more of a risk, that more of the onus is on them. But you are taking an investment risk. So there's this argument of this. But also, there was a time when capital gains tax rates were substantially higher, but investors benefited from something called indexation, where only the return above inflation was taxed. So there is, you know, the natural amount that something will go up to match inflation, and then there's the profit on top of it, and you only pay the tax on the profit on top of it. That was torn up when the rates of capital gains were lowered substantially. The concern is that what would happen is that the rates of capital gains will go up. Whether they'd go up to meet income tax is not clear, because actually there's quite a lot of data on capital gains tax and what happens if you move the rates, because the rates have been moved around so much in the past in this country and many other countries. And what happens is, if you move them up by a bit, you get more money in because you still get the same level of transactions, people, you know, selling and so on. If you move them up by a lot, you can see the tax take drop, even though the rate is higher, because people just sit on the asset and they don't sell it. Easier to do with shares. You'd say harder to do with a buy-to-let or something, but you might have the situation where someone's got big buy-to-let profits and they say, well, do you know what? I just won't sell it now because I just have to pay a load of tax on it. I'll sit on it for 5 years. It might be out by then, or they might have lowered the rate again. So you don't necessarily get in more money, but you can see a scenario where they would put up the rate, you know, but they wouldn't reintroduce indexation. And actually, interestingly, if you want to know how that would work, that was what the Lib Dems were proposing for capital gains tax, was equalize the rates, but reintroduce indexing for inflation.
Helen, lots about wealth taxes, lots about putting up taxes, changing tax. What about any kind of help for those people who are really suffering? You know, there's a lot of talk about getting rid of the winter fuel payment. That seems to have blown up in Labour's face a little bit. But what about the support for those people that need it? Are we going to get anything like that?
The winter fuel payment issue has really blown up over the last couple of weeks. So obviously the plan is that that's going to be cut for pensioners who aren't claiming certain benefits. That's really caused some anger among especially older people. There's been some talk about other changes that could be made. So under the last government, there were some changes to sort of benefits, thresholds and allowances. And there's been some talk that perhaps they will be reversed. So things will be, this will environment will be slightly easier for people who claim, especially those kind of benefits that working people claim. So child benefit and different kind of tax allowances like that. But it does seem to be generally, as Simon said, it's a very kind of gloomy, looking very gloomy going to this autumn budget. It doesn't seem like there's been an awful lot of good news floating around so far. I don't know if there's anything that I've missed, but it's, seems like a bit of a negative Nelly kind of budget, if I'm honest.
Will the negative Nelly budget work, Simon? Surely the way out of this is not to tax people even more when we're already massively highly taxed, but it's to emphasise growth. And like you said, no one's going to come to your party if you're sitting in the corner crying and telling everyone how rubbish it is.
Yeah, so I would say the issue with this is that Labour made a mistake. I believe the same mistake the Tories made before them is they painted themselves into a corner by promising not to raise the rates of income tax, national insurance, corporation tax, or VAT. So they're in a scenario, those raise a huge amount of the revenue that comes into the government, the lion's share. So they've got themselves into a position where the levers that they can pull are very, very limited. This makes it harder for them to sort out some of the stuff that does need to be sorted out and is causing a problem. So frozen tax thresholds are a major issue. We've had massive fiscal drag. We have seen, you know, what it means to be a high earner radically redefined as, you know, record numbers of people are dragged into 40% tax. They then, if they are lucky enough to earn more than £100,000, pay 60% tax between 100 and 125, at which point it drops to 45% tax after Jeremy Hunt lowered the 45% tax threshold to just over £125,000. So that's like the picture of the UK tax system. Those thresholds, you know, at the lower end have been frozen, pulls more people into tax, pulls more people into higher rate tax. The £100,000 amount hasn't moved since it was introduced, you know, a long time ago. It should, if it had gone up with inflation, it should be £150,000. If you look at what I was alluding to earlier, I wrote something about this just before the election. Now, what happened to tax over 14 years of the Tory government? Tory government has actually reduced taxes on lower earners and middle earners, and it has increased them on higher earners. But it's got to the point now where those higher earners are doing quite a lot of grumbling about this, feeling very put upon and so on. And even though actually, probably most of those higher earners wouldn't pay capital gains tax in any given year. Hopefully, they're lucky enough to not face any inheritance tax liability in any given year because no members of their family or themselves die. you know, they're probably much more likely to go over the savings, personal savings allowance, which again hasn't risen. But, you know, it won't cost them that much. They're not going to have that much in saving interest. Despite all those things not happening, right, it all feels like just more of the squeeze that's going on. And if Labour do what we're talking about here, you know, we don't know what they're going to do. They might not do anything, okay? If they do this, then it's just going to feel like even more of that squeeze. And there is a scenario where people feel squeezed. They just save more money. They put more aside. We saw this. It's really interesting. The Bank of England put something out on this week, basically, which is in this sort of weird scenario where when we had really low interest rates, you would expect people to spend more money, to not save money. But actually, the people who could save money just saved even harder because they weren't getting an interest rate return on their money. So you get this kind of weird psychology scenario going on. And I think it will just add to that. And it'll add to that at a time when we need the opposite to happen. We need people to feel a little bit more stable, a little bit more, you know, financially carefree. We've just come off COVID, the cost of living crisis, the inflation spike, all those other things. The economy is picking up. And, you know, I would have envisaged a situation where you delay the budget until the end of October. Rachel Reeves stands up. Inflation's come down to target. Economy's picking up. Labour could claim credit for that, even though it's picking up at the end of the Tories being in charge. Interest rates have come down, which has the benefit of reducing our interest costs on the national debt. The figures look better. And then they basically say, we're going to unfreeze tax thresholds. We're going to put them up with inflation from April, which everyone will go, this is great. This is brilliant. And it's not going to cost them that much money because actually inflation in April is going to be quite low. And they're not giving you back what you lost before from the really high inflation. And it makes it all look kind of better. So they could have done that. But instead, there's been this weird, gloomy stuff that we've been talking about. But there is an alternative scenario here. Maybe this isn't like the kitchen sinking that we think it is and the gloom and everything else, like rolling the pitch for tax rises. Maybe this is just overplaying it early and then they come and deliver like quite a good budget. Perhaps even one that puts a little bit more money in people's pockets rather than taking it off them, you know. But I would have argued that that might be the case. But with everything I see, I'm increasingly less convinced that that is what's actually going to happen.
It's also like, what's the point in doing that? It's not like they need the votes or anything. They're in. They've done it. Well, so get out like, the bad news now, no?
Yeah,
then
maybe,
they can have more
maybe,
power in about 5 years' but, time when they need it or more money.
There's fixing the foundations and there's making everyone want to go hide under a rock for the next 5 years. And I'm not sure the two things are exactly the same.
No, indeed not. Look, we did mention, we spoke about capital gains, inheritance tax. I did say we'd talk about pension savings as well, because there's been a lot about this. New figures show the cost of providing tax relief on pension savings of up to 6 million higher earners has surged. So could Rachel Reeves be eyeing that area up? You've been speaking to Sir Steve Webb, I believe, or he's been making comment. Helen, just firstly, how does pension tax relief work and why might Rachel Reeves be eyeing that up?
At the moment, the way that pension tax relief works is that it depends on your tax band. So if you are on the 20% tax rate, you're a base rate taxpayer, you get 20% tax relief on your pension contributions. If you're 40% taxpayer, you get 40% relief, and 45, you get 45. So essentially, it's completely tax-free. Whatever your tax band is, that's matched with the amount of relief you get on your pension contributions. So the idea of that is obviously to encourage people to save money for their retirement. You know, that has a huge benefit to the state as well when people do that, because it means they're potentially sort of less dependent in their older age. And that's kind of, you know, it works very well for savers, obviously. However, it costs the government an incredible amount of money to provide that relief. So 48.7 billion in the 2022-23 tax year, and a lot of that relief obviously goes to hiring additional rate taxpayers, because they're the ones that tend to put more money into their pensions. So, you know, it's a policy that works for savers, but for the government it's really expensive. And it comes back to that kind of broad shoulders idea, I guess, because what's being mooted for this budget is that perhaps a flat rate would come in. So instead of some people getting 20% relief, some people getting 40% relief, everyone would get 30% relief. So that would be good for lower earners because they'd be getting additional tax relief, more than kind of the amount that they were putting in. But people who are putting more will obviously have to pay some tax on their contributions. That's obviously really controversial, but it seems like something that is quite likely for this budget. So as you said, we spoke to Steve Webb and he said there's no doubt that the Chancellor will be eyeing up the large price tag attached to providing tax relief on pension contributions. It would be a huge change to how the policy works now. And I think it's risky because, you know, we do want to encourage people to save for retirement. We already have a lot of people who aren't probably putting away enough. And I think anything that discourages people from that further is potentially quite dangerous.
No, I'm against this. There are many people who are for it, okay? But I have always been against this. I was against it when I was a basic rate taxpayer. I'm against it now. I'm a higher rate taxpayer. I think that there's a couple of things that are an issue here. Firstly, I think the way it's talked about as, you know, being expensive, the price tag on it, all that kind of stuff, not blaming Helen, who was just basically explaining what the background of the story is here. I think that is wrong because actually, is it the cost of this or is it actually that what's happening is the government isn't collecting tax on our pension contributions, that we're able to pay into our pension from tax-free earnings. So it's not necessarily the cost, it's the money that they've foregone. And if you've always foregone the money, it's not a cost. It's like when we talk about the cost of not charging people capital gains tax on selling their own home. It's like, yeah, there is a nominal and theoretical cost of that. But basically the principle is, you don't pay tax when you sell your home that you live in. There is also, you know, a principle here that you save into your pension from tax-free income, right? And then you pay tax on the income from your pension at the other end. It's often described as a perk, but I think arguably it is a principle. And like all principles, I think you mess with it at your peril. Now, obviously, the cost of giving the tax relief, so there you go, I'm committing the same sin that I just talked about, but the theoretical cost of giving the tax relief to higher earners is more, right? And they actually benefit from this more. It does look like this system is massively tilted in the favour of 40% and 45% taxpayers. But that's because if you want to get them back to the position they were in on their pension contributions before they paid tax, you have to give them more because they're paying more tax in the first place. It's just simple maths. And actually, when we talk about the cost of this rising by a billion, 1.1 billion, what we also have to remember is, why is that happening? What lies behind that? Oh yeah, we made a load more people higher rate taxpayers. That's why we're having to give them more money on their pension tax relief. And actually, we're making money on this. We're getting more money in from dragging more of them into 40% tax than we are paying out on the pension tax relief. If we're talking about costs, this is more just like the cost of doing business, you know, and it's a bit of business that ain't great for us lot. It's a bit of business that's better for the government. I also think that you start meddling with these things at your peril, because once you change it from it's just at your rate of tax, and there are limits on how much you can put into a pension, okay? This isn't just to kind of like go completely nuts and put as much as you want in. And those limits are actually much stricter than they were when the previous Labour government left power. Once you start meddling with the percentage, well, you open the door to somebody meddling with it further down the line. I mean, you start with a 30% flat rate, but then who's to say that this chancellor or another chancellor doesn't say, well, we need a bit more money. We're going to make it 27 and then it's 25 and then it's 20 and then everybody's just back to basic rate and then it's down below it. You can see it being whittled down, can't you? Because that's exactly how these things happened. If you only need to look at stamp duty as a point of comparison, which until Gordon Brown started meddling with it, wasn't a problem. Flat, 1%, homes over £60,000, no real problem with stamp duty. But he like changed the rates, upped them a little bit, and he couldn't help but up them a little bit more. And then George Osborne couldn't help but up them a little bit more. And before you know it, you've created a massive problem. So I don't think you should do that. I also think that there's a really big danger here of people being diddled on their flat rate owing to the sort of general grasp of mathematics not necessarily being what it could be. I read an incredible stat the other day that was something like half of adults only have like primary school grasp of maths. And then I thought about it and I thought, well, actually, that's fair enough. I mean, that's basically like my kid, my youngest daughter's just finished primary school, and I look at some of her maths and I'm like, how do I do that again? And I'm quite good at maths. So I'm like, oh no, actually, that's probably fair enough. But what are we talking about here when we talk about 30%? Are we talking about an uplift of 30% on what you put in? Or are we talking about turning £70 that you put in into £100? Because that's what the proponents of flat rate tax relief talk about, to turn 70 into 100. But you could see how the Chancellor might try to sell us the 30% uplift instead, because there's quite a big difference between those numbers, right? Because to take it from 70 to 100 is actually a 43% uplift. So you could save yourself a bit of money there, couldn't you? So yeah, I'm not for this, but also I'm not sure it's going to happen, because it would cause quite a lot of potential problems. Some of them involve defined benefit pensions, which are largely in the public sector. You might find that some higher earning doctors, teachers, police officers, there's probably a lot of train drivers still on final salary pensions, aren't there? I don't know. Sorry if you're a train driver and you don't get them anymore. They would then start having to have an extra tax charge put on them in order to deal with this. Salary sacrifice, it would cause a massive problem for that. You'd either have to scrap salary sacrifice altogether, or people would be able to salary sacrifice their pension, but then they'd have to pay a tax charge off the back of it. And you could see how it would cause problems, right? And so that's always been the argument as to why this won't happen. It's too complicated to cause too many problems. And also, if I was the Labour Party, I probably wouldn't want to ignite another argument over pensions with doctors, teachers, police officers, etc. So there's very strong arguments as to why it wouldn't happen. But I must admit, I do think that this is probably of all the times you get this rumour, this is probably the most likely the rumour might be to actually happen occasion. But I would also say, if I was Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer, I would not do anything that would mean anybody could write the headline Labour raids pensions, because that's another thing that they really, really, really want to avoid continuing their reputation for doing, because that's the thing that always gets pinned on Gordon Brown. He sold the gold, he raided our pensions. So don't do anything that could trigger that headline. If I was there, you know, the spin doctor or whatever, I would just say no. Do not make it that the Labour's first move, raid your pensions.
Is there anything that, let's say they don't have a spin doctor that advises that, is there anything they could do that's less fiendishly complicated, which is what it sounds like you were describing here, that they could do to get some money off pensions, pensioners, that area? Is there anything else that could be in the pipeline if it's not to make it a flat rate?
There is one thing, but it wouldn't raise that much revenue, which I think the possibility that at the moment pensions have, it's described as having an inheritance tax benefit. I think this is actually overcooked. Basically, if you have a pension and you leave it to someone and you die below the age of 75, generally not considered a win, I would say. No. You or your relative dying below the age of 75, then it can be passed on completely tax-free, and the people who inherit it don't pay any tax when they get it. If you die after the age of 75, then the people who get your pension pay tax at their income tax rate on the money that they withdraw from it, which actually means that if they were to take out a substantial amount of money, as it's going to be added to their other income, they'd probably end up paying 40% tax on it anyway. This is because pensions sit outside of the inheritance tax net. There's a lot of talk of bringing them inside the inheritance tax net. I could see that potentially being something that happened as well. But again, it wouldn't really bring in that much money. I could also, with inheritance tax, I could see some of the loopholes trying to be shut. So I could see, for example, the stuff that the very rich take advantage of, agricultural land, farmland, business assets, then also moving down into the kind of, you know, affluent, wealthier savers, AIM shares, things like that. I could see some of that being targeted. Again, though, it would create problems. You know, some of that stuff is in there. It might be that the very rich are buying up farmland for its inheritance tax benefits, but the reason why it's originally in there was to stop family farms being broken up when, you know, people died and stuff like that. So it doesn't come without its perils. And actually, arguably, inheritance tax needs a total overhaul anyway. I mean, what I'd really like Rachel Reeves to do is scrap this gloomy nonsense and just like stand up and say, do you know what? What we have identified a number of problems in the tax system, ranging from, you know, the outdated inheritance tax reliefs, to the 60% tax trap, to the child benefit issue. We're going to fix this winter fuel thing. Actually, we were wrong. And we're going to basically rip up the whole thing and start again with a much simpler system. And I think that they would really benefit from that. But with everything I hear, it seems less and less likely it's going to happen.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Rob Morgan of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Rob, a US tech star, Nvidia, released its results this week. It's one of the members of the so-called Magnificent Seven. Why do these US stocks matter so much to investors at the moment?
Yes, so the Magnificent Seven are among the biggest and most influential companies in the world. They are Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, which is the parent company of Google, Microsoft, Nvidia, the AI chip maker, Meta, aka Facebook, and Tesla. And these tend to be lumped together as a group among investors owing to their really rapid growth, which has come about from harnessing cutting edge technology, as well as their dominance in stock market returns in the US market and therefore global markets for much of the past decade. So these seven companies currently account for over 20% of the entire global stock market. So their influence on market returns and our own investment portfolios, including our pensions, is considerable. And to put this into some perspective, the seven stocks combined are larger than all of the Japanese, UK, Chinese and French stock markets combined. So almost everyone with any kind of investments has considerable exposure to them. And to illustrate the influence they've had, if we take last year, 2023, as an example, which was a good year for markets, the market was up about 20%. The Magnificent Seven was responsible for 2/3 of that rise. So they've been really important to investors and remain so.
And is there any risk from the Magnificent Seven dominating markets by so much?
Yeah, so when markets are highly concentrated like this, there's more risk involved in investing in line with the index via a passive fund or an ETF, for instance. It's a kind of top-heavy market. The constituents carry a bigger influence on returns, and that means investors are more reliant on those companies carrying on delivering than they would be with a flatter, more evenly distributed market. And recent volatility has illustrated that these companies do carry risks. Their combined value slumped 15% at one point between July and earlier this month, for instance. So that's a big move for the largest companies in the world. And it's also unusual for one group of stocks to be so dominant in markets for such a long period of time. So that's pause for thought as well. The Magnificent Seven are generally great companies. That's not really the issue. They're established, very profitable, potentially contain some of the big winners from artificial intelligence or other avenues of growth going forward, but their shares are expensive in relation to their earnings. So they are already priced for very strong growth. So if one of them disappoints, the share price tends to get punished quite severely. And that was demonstrated by Nvidia this week. It produced some really, really strong results, but shares fell back regardless, suggesting really that many investors were expecting something even more blockbuster from them. So investors already very used to this very considerable growth from the Magnificent Seven, and expectations are getting tougher to beat each time they report earnings. Perhaps the other members of the group aren't as risky, perhaps, as Nvidia. Generally, they're more diverse businesses. But the same principle applies to investors, that if the bar keeps setting getting set higher and higher, then the company are going to have a harder and harder time clearing it, which is why we think going forward, there's likely to be both winners and losers among the Magnificent Seven. They're actually quite a diverse group of businesses, each with their own growth drivers, as well as particular fragilities and uncertainties.
Rob, thank you very much.
Welcome back. Right, away from the budget, and first-time buyers could now be able to secure a bigger mortgage when applying with Halifax. The mortgage lender announced that it's making £2 billion available for those looking to get on the property ladder and need to borrow up to 5.5 times their annual income. Now, to be eligible, buyers need a total household income of £50,000 or more, which will need to come from employment, and they'll also need to have a deposit of at least 10%. Helen, tell me more about the details. How will this work? Is it worth it? How does it compare to other deals?
So this £2 billion available thing did kind of make me laugh, because it's not just free money, is it? You know, Halifax aren't just giving first-time buyers £2 billion of money. They're lending it to them in mortgages, which they're going to pay back, you know, potentially many times over in interest. But it is quite good news, potentially for some kinds of first-time buyers. So what they're doing is, normally when you take a mortgage, the average sort of person going to a bank, to a broker, sorting their mortgage, can borrow 4.5 times their household income. So people might need to borrow less, but the maximum you can normally get is 4.5 from most lenders. What Halifax is saying is that for some first-time buyers now who meet certain criteria, they can borrow up to 5.5 times their annual household income. Now, that's helpful for people who maybe earn enough to pay a mortgage but are struggling to raise the amount of deposit that they need. So to get this Halifax deal, you need to earn £50,000 or more. So that could be on your own or combined between, say, two people buying together. And you do need to have a deposit of at least 10%. But what this extra lending could let you do is, for example, buy a more expensive house than the one you might be able to buy with borrowing just 4.5 times your salary, or it could give you enough borrowing capability to get on the ladder, whereas otherwise you might not have been able to borrow enough money in your sort of deposit plus the house price to actually get on the ladder. So it's, you know, you do still need to be able to cover the mortgage payments, obviously. And if you're borrowing more, then your mortgage is clearly going to be more expensive. So that's the kind of caveat with this. You know, being able to borrow more than you otherwise would be able to do is great, but your mortgage is going to be more expensive. And can you afford that? So that there are, you know, this isn't a completely new thing. Some other banks offer this to certain first-time buyers. Santander, for example, I think HSBC will let some first-time buyers do it as well, depending on their earnings. It's just a bit of, you know, extra flexibility, really. It's not going to work for everyone, but if you're the kind of person or the kind of couple who earns a fairly decent salary, perhaps you're paying quite high rent already and you're thinking, you know, I'm paying X amount of rent, I could probably get a mortgage for cheaper than this, but we don't have enough saved for a deposit. They're the kind of people that this could potentially help kind of get over that hurdle.
All right, while you're on a roll, Helen, you've been back on the case, Crane on the case. This week, it's all about my bête noire, the embarrassment of all delivery firms, nay, the embarrassment of all businesses, full stop. It is every, I have a Nest camera, so I've seen the time they've just let my parcel fall out of their hand to the floor. Like they don't care. No doorbell rang, just a parcel chucked on the floor. Not even chucked, gently rolling off their hand. Who knows if it was breakable? Anyway, that's if it arrives. Anyway, Helen, take up the story. Otherwise, I'm just going to dominate this section and I don't want to.
It is quite a highly contested category, isn't it? Worst parcel delivery company. I don't think any of them are particularly great, but from what I hear, at least, Evri is potentially one of the most hated. So this is a reader that wrote in. He sells vintage signs on eBay, and he had this really interesting item that he's sent a picture of. If you have a look at the article, you can see it. It's a vintage motor oil sign. And it has a working thermometer, on the side. I know nothing about cars. I don't know if like the temperature of motor oil is something you would need to measure or why this is a thing, but it's quite a cool sort of quirky vintage item. So he sold this to a buyer and obviously gone to post it to their address. He's used every, and this from what he says is where he kind of went wrong. So sent it away, sent it first class next day delivery. So I was hoping it'd be there fairly easily. It didn't arrive. Every told him that this was because they couldn't access the property because it was along an unmade track. I think it's quite a rural area and it's just a kind of side track off a road, and the drivers all wouldn't go there. So he was like, okay, sent them a different address. They couldn't deliver to that one either. At this point, he's obviously getting a bit worried, getting a bit angry. eBay makes him refund the buyer because the item hasn't arrived. This sign, by the way, cost £365. So this is quite a rare thing. It's quite quite high value. It's quite unique as well. So not something you really want to get lost. And then after it hasn't been delivered twice, every basically just tells him it's lost. It's lost somewhere in our network. And, you know, sorry. It's gone. So he says, quite rightly, could I please have the money for the £365 sign you've lost? And they offer him £20 because that's the maximum apparently that they'll refund you if you don't take out insurance. So when you post a parcel, they quite often say, do you want to take out extra insurance for this? And he thought, you know, it's next day delivery. This is a very large item. It's probably not going to get lost. It's enamel. So how easy is it to get damaged? But turns out it clearly was quite easy for it to get lost and damaged because that's exactly what happened. Every's argument was, well, you should have taken the insurance. But it's kind of annoys me because I think, you know, you're buying a service and I think you do have to have a basic level of trust in a delivery company that it will get your parcel.
Exactly, that's your job. Why am I taking insurance for you to do your job?
Yeah, I don't think you should have to take out insurance for a company to do the thing that you've paid it to do. Anyway, he got in touch with me. I spoke to Every. They did agree to pay him back in the end, but only as a goodwill gesture. They pointed out that he should have taken the insurance, and if he had, it would have been covered up to £999. But interestingly, they also sort of changed their story. So they'd initially told him that it was lost in the network, and he'd actually said, well, this is quite an interesting sort of rare item. Can you please continue to look for it? Which I think they said after 5 days, they're like, oh, we've not found it, so sorry. And he was like, well, can you keep looking? Which I think is their question. But when they came back to me again, they said that actually it hadn't been lost, that it had been damaged. So it seems like unlikely that he's ever going to see that again, but he has got the money back. So that's the that's the kind of good news of the story. It just seems, I said in the article, it just posting anything just seems like such an absolute hazard these days. It's, you know, lost, like you say, dropped on your doorstep, thrown over your neighbor's fence, stolen, you know, it's an absolute, yeah, just trying to send a parcel to someone at the minute, I feel.
I'm trying to find out how much extra you'd have to pay for insurance, but I'll be honest with you, Helen, I'm not great at multitasking. So I'm listening to you talk and I'm trying to find, and honestly, I can't. So do you know how much it is to, or is it dependent on what you're sending? There's a lot of different pricings here.
Yeah, I think it depends on the value of what you're sending, but I mean, it wouldn't be
insurance, the amount of the item that you're sending.
I would guess, you know, I don't know exactly for this item, but it, you know, it's normally £5, £10, which, but you know, if you're already paying, I think he said he paid about £7.50 to send this. Do you really want to kind of double that for insurance? I mean, it's already quite expensive. I can definitely see why people don't take it. And then presume with this insurance, you know, there's a huge list of small print that, you know, if something's not packaged properly or something like, then it won't cover it. So I completely understand why people don't take it. I wouldn't take out insurance if I was sending a parcel. I'd be like, I trust you to send it properly.
I think if you're a small business, I think that you would just have to say when you list an item that, you know, to make sure that this gets to you, we have to charge this amount for the insurance. I mean, Simon, what's your views?
We were talking about this in the office this week, ahead of the Crane on the Case publication, because we get a secret insight into the cases before they land live for readers to read. largely because Helen writes them and she sits opposite me, so we can talk about them. But we were so, basically, it was a bit mealy-mouthed. It was a bit like, well, you're lucky we delivered it, and you're lucky we deliver any parcels in the first place kind of attitude. I mean, it's not strictly true, but it's like, well, 99% of our parcels arrive. So, yeah, but people are paying to deliver a parcel. Stop humble bragging. I think that, yes, you could say, well, if you were sending something of such value, of course you should insure it. But then also, if you were paying someone to carry out a job or a service for you and they fail to carry out that job or service, then you should theoretically expect them to reimburse you for full, not demand that you pay some insurance to make sure that they do, particularly as you know they're making money off the insurance on top of the actual cost of selling people, you know, the service, which is delivering packages. So I don't think these parcel firms talking about this have got a leg to stand on, really. I think actually if someone gives you a parcel and you fail to deliver it and it goes missing, it's on you and you have to reimburse them in full. I could see maybe, you know, perhaps like you can do this when you get a passport and stuff, can't you? Or, you know, if you're sending something like that, like important documents, and it's like, if they go missing, there will be a knock-on cost. If there's a knock-on cost, then maybe that's fair enough to like pay some insurance for or something. But if the item just vanishes into thin air, then the person you've paid to carry out the service should reimburse you in full stop.
Well, I agree. Does every company do this?
I have no idea, but I know that there are many, many people trying to sell you insurance for things. We're going to talk about Oasis tickets in a moment, aren't we? Anybody lucky enough to get themselves either a pre-sale code or get themselves through the queue and finally manage to buy a ticket is going to be offered the chance to buy some insurance for those tickets. I bought some other gig tickets yesterday and I was tried to be sold insurance. And then it said, do you really want to go ahead without the insurance? Are you sure? Do you know the risk you're taking? It didn't say, do you know the risk you're taking? But it was like, do you know the risk you're taking? Like, well, it's like £60 worth of concert tickets. And yeah, I know that if I can't go, or if I get delayed or something like that, or I get ill, then I can't go. I think I can handle this. We had a story recently about when you pay for parking on these confounded bloody apps that you have to pay for parking with nowadays, where they already charge you a little, you know, can't use a parking machine anymore, you have to use the app, but they'll charge you a little fee on top of the parking for using the app. Now they try to sell you some insurance for while you're parked.
What?
Yeah, it's insurance, like in case anything goes wrong while you're parked. Again, you know, how much stuff this would actually pay out for. I think the claim is that it would pay out if someone broke into your car, but would it claim if someone drives into your car while it's parked there? I mean, I've got my
car insurance. Does that not cover that?
What's that? Your car insurance. Well, exactly. Most people are covered by their car insurance. But it's all this kind of like sneaky little, do you want to insure that? You know, it's like, it's all a bit like the kind of warranty on the toaster at Argos, isn't it? Although actually,
it costs £15.
Warranties on toasters are probably the best thing to take out because no toaster ever lasts more than 2 years anyway. So,
all right then. Look, Helen, what do they say? Are they actually that bad? Yeah.
A spokesperson for Evri said, we offer a low cost and reliable service with 99% of the millions of parcels we handle delivered on time. Our standard service includes free cover up to £20 for most items, and for higher value goods, we encourage all customers to take additional cover. Every parcel matters to us, and we're sorry that DH's experience has not been a positive, that might be my typo, has not been positive, and we've offered a goodwill payment.
Can I tell you a quick story? I had an Italian friend who flew over some years ago, and I picked her up from the airport. And on the way back from the airport, she told me that she'd been on the Ryanair flight, and Ryanair did that thing where they made the announcement. This is another Ryanair flight that's landed on time. 96% of Ryanair flights land on time. There was an Italian couple in front of her, and she heard one of them turn to the other one and say, did you hear that? That's terrible. They just said only 96% of their flights land. That's not good at all. Why are they talking about that? It's like she really wanted to do that thing where you intervene and say, that's not what they said. Think about it for a minute. That's not what they said. They wouldn't still be flying planes if only 96% of them landed. But she felt, you know, she's like, I was overhearing someone's conversation. I can't really butt in. So this couple wandered off and maybe
thought they'll never fly Ryanair again.
I don't know. Or they never flew Ryanair again?
No, I wouldn't. Right. Okay, you mentioned Oasis there. So you have a reader question. They plan to attend at least one of the Oasis reunion gigs, probably at Wembley Stadium. But they are concerned because of the history between the Gallagher brothers. The bad blood could resurface before these 2025 concerts. And so if they buy a ticket, can they buy insurance? Should they buy insurance to protect themselves if the gigs are cancelled? Times are tight for me, they say, financially, and I've no doubt that these Oasis tickets will be very expensive. So, Simon?
Well, I mean, the hot topic of conversation this week hasn't only been Every. It has also been Oasis. I mean, what a week to announce you were going to do the gigs. Last week of summer, everything's a bit quiet. Mm. Talk about dominating the headlines. There's been a lot of chat about it. But you've got to think that, you know, whilst it there's a lot of money at stake for the Gallagher brothers, there is the potential that their volatile relationship does blow up between now and next summer. Right. So if you are lucky enough to get hold of one of those tickets, which, you know, I'm trying to get hold of some of those tickets.
Mm.
Helen's trying to get hold of some of those tickets.
Are they on sale yet? It's sort of passed me by. I've been looking at deadline transfer day and stuff.
There's been this whole pre-sale rigmarole. I suspect the whole thing's being run by the Google and Microsoft because due to the extra amount of advertising they can sell on Gmail and Outlook from people frantically checking their emails to see if they've got the confirmation for the pre-sale that they actually tried to enter, and then their pre-sale code. The tickets go on sale on Saturday morning.
How many gigs?
By the time many people listen to this, they may already be sold out. Apparently there's going to be 1 million tickets, but they reckon there's going to be 4 million people who want them. You know, and you would also like to think that if this is money readers have thought about the potential for this blowing up before the gig happens, that the promoters have thought about this too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there is the big question of, you know, what happens. So both will give you a refund of the ticket price if an event is cancelled, provided the tickets came from them and not via a scalper or a reseller. However, Ticketmaster reserves the right not to refund any sales fees. So Ticketmaster's terms and conditions for concert cancellations state that service charges and order processing fees may be non-refundable. And those can be very, very expensive, i.e. you could end up paying, I don't know, 50 quid in fees, maybe, on four tickets. You probably end up paying more than 50 quid in fees on four tickets, wouldn't you? What do you reckon, Helen?
Yeah, I think so. I've definitely, during COVID, had gig tickets cancelled where the non-refunded like booking fees and venue fees were about 10, 12 quid a ticket. It's like parcels. Everything's got loads of fees nowadays. Like, they just bung loads of costs of like printing your ticket, print at home ticket fee, like app ticket fee. It's, and not that I'm jaded with like going to gigs or anything. Yeah, it could easily be for four tickets, like 50 quid, maybe.
So can you get insurance?
Of course you could get insurance. Like, so look, but I must admit, I've never paid out for ticket insurance in my life, and I have no intention of paying out for ticket insurance. I think it's a swizz. But I think it's one of those things where you can just take your chances. And if something happens that means you can't go, I think you're probably going to be able to sell the tickets to someone. Don't sell them on ViaGoGo or Seatwave. You know, don't be a bedroom tout. Find someone who wants them and sell them to them for face value. You know, don't try and profiteer from it. But I do think that if you can't go, you're probably going to be able to sell these tickets. If the insurance that you're offered will cover you if you can't attend due to problems at your end, such as illness, your car breaking down. Ticketmaster's insurance, for example, pays if you or a companion are too ill to attend, if a family member falls seriously ill, you'll need a doctor's note to say that. Mm. If a family member or any gig companion dies, also for things such as missed gigs due to quarantines, your car breaking down, jury service, public transport disruptions. Again, you're going to need quite a lot of evidence on that one, and home emergencies. But it will not pay out for lost and stolen tickets, accommodation costs, or missing gigs due to pre-existing medical conditions, natural disasters, and I don't really even want to say this, terrorist attacks.
All right then, fair enough. And if you can't get tickets, I think Noasis are performing in my local park in a couple of weeks' time, so I'll just go along to that. Right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debates in reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.